Hey, welcome everybody to Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. Just to let you know what's coming up, Hugh's starting a new series next week regarding his new book, Design to the Core. And Ken Samples will be here on the 17th. But happy Independence Day to everybody in the United States. And tomorrow will be also call it 4th of July celebration for us. This week, Dr. Ross will be finishing up creation and the origin of the needed elements. Remember, he started that a couple weeks ago. Those of you here, please silence your phones. We're taping this, saved on YouTube. Thank you for bringing the food to those who did. Quite a few of you, so. We really appreciate it. Restrooms are on my left. Just follow the signs. And I wanted to recommend Dr. Ross's new book, Design to the Core. Just came out. I don't think it's available yet for sale, but it will be at any moment. And so let me read something on the back to get you kind of excited about this. One of the commenters, I have read books and articles that describe the rare earth hypothesis, that is, that our planet enjoys a remarkable place in the solar system, and that our solar system resides in the optimal place in the Milky Way galaxy. Design to the Core is the first book I've ever read that explains how the Milky Way galaxy itself is special and unique, the rare galaxy hypothesis. Hugh Ross has a remarkable ability to gather and synthesize enormous amounts of technical data, and then present it in a way that is a scientific layperson like me can understand. It's from Ken Keithley. So, with that, Dr. Ross, please.
Well, as Mark just announced, we're going to wrap up the series on the origin of the elements that are needed for us to have human civilization on the Earth and actually to have salvation of billions of human beings possible. If you missed the first couple of segments of that presentation, you can go to paradoxes.org and you can download the recordings, either in video or audio. And yes. Thanks for introducing this book, Design to the Core. It will be available for the next 6 weeks to anyone for donation to Reasons to Believe of any amount. After that, it will go on sale. And it's not just the rare galaxy hypothesis. It's the rare Virgo cluster hypothesis, the rare Lanikaia supercluster hypothesis, the rare local bubble, the rare local arm. You get the idea. It's designed all the way down to the core. That's kind of why they chose the title that they did. Well, let me wrap up this series. We'll have a time for Q&A. And then next week, we'll launch a brand new series. As I mentioned last week, I did teach a very short course on this book at Biola University. And I've slightly expanded on that. And that'll be a series we'll be teaching here in the Paradoxes classes. So this first slide here is just simply a reminder for those of you that are watching online, those of you that are here in person. If you think of a great question tomorrow or the next day, you can pose those questions to me on both my Facebook and Twitter page. And if you put into a search engine, Hugh Ross Facebook, that'll pop up my page. For the Twitter page, you're going to have to put in Hugh Ross RTB, and then it'll pop up. Otherwise, you'll get some site that we created years ago and haven't been able to get rid of. So a lot of what we're going to be hearing about today is in this book, The Creator and the Cosmos. Anyone can get a free chapter of that book at reasons.org/Ross. But the latest update on Earth's unique elements are in this book, Design to the Core, and it actually talks about the unique elemental abundances in the sun and the moon, as well as the Earth, all of which play a crucial role. We have to fine-tune the diversity and abundance of elements in the sun, moon, as well as the Earth, and for that matter, in the comets and asteroids in our solar system, in order to make it possible for billions of people to live here at one time on planet Earth. So this is the theme, And we've been talking about the periodic table, which all of you can remember back to your elementary school education or junior high. Being educated in Canada, we got this very early. But these are the elements that make up the periodic table. I mentioned last week that it takes three successive generations in the history of the universe, three successive generations of stars to make all the elements we see in the periodic table. And this actually takes you up to all the elements that existed on the Earth when the Earth had first formed. Today we have 92 elements, but the one I'm showing you here is 94 elements, because when the Earth was young, there was also Neptunian and plutonium, natural Neptunian and plutonium, but because they have half-lives of only in the tens of millions of years, those have completely decayed away at this point. But what I want to do in wrapping up here is look at a few of the elements in the periodic table that astronomers and physicists now recognize that Earth has an anomalous abundance. And what I mean by that is, I think this is unique to us at Reasons to Believe. What we did is we took the abundance of elements in Earth's crust, the abundance of the different elements, and compared that with the abundance of elements we see in our Milky Way galaxy and we see in the universe as a whole, where we subtract out the hydrogen and the helium. You say, why do you do that? Well, Earth's gravity is not sufficient to retain hydrogen and helium if that hydrogen and helium gets into the atmosphere or the ocean. It simply dissipates to outer space. Our gravity is strong enough to retain water, but it can't retain the hydrogen or the helium. And so we're looking at everything else, all the other elements. And what we notice is when we compare the diversity and abundance of elements in our Milky Way galaxy and compare it with the universe, it's almost identical, almost no difference whatsoever. And actually, if you look at the abundance of elements in the Earth's crust compared to the universe and our Milky Way galaxy, where we subtract away the hydrogen and helium, Earth is normal when it comes to iron and manganese. It's anomalous on virtually everything else in the periodic table. But what I'm doing here in these three slides I'm going to be focusing on is looking at the elements in the periodic table where the Earth's crust has a highly anomalous abundance relative to the rest of the universe and our Milky Way galaxy. But I'm focusing on those elements that are either essential for life or they're essential for us humans to be able to launch and sustain global civilization. So this first slide is looking at the elements that are essential for life. And there are 22 elements in the periodic table that we call vital poisons. And you'll see an in-depth discussion of that in this book, Design to the Core. But here I've just selected six of them. And these are elements where if they have too low of an abundance, all life dies. If they have too high of an abundance, likewise, all life dies. So that's why we put the title vital poison. You need them to live, but too little or too much will be deadly. But what we see is phosphorus. I mean, next to carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, phosphorus is the most essential element for life to possibly exist. And we look in the crust of the Earth, we see our planet has four times as much phosphorus as what we see in the rest of our Milky Way galaxy or the universe. And so one reason why life is abundant on planet Earth is because we have this superabundance of phosphorus. Even so, the amount of phosphorus on the Earth is a limiting factor. So that's why typically we try to find phosphorus-rich fertilizers in order to be able to grow more food, because this team seems to be a limiting factor. But if it wasn't for the fact that we were living on a planet where the planet's crust had this huge amount of phosphorus relative to the rest of our Milky Way galaxy, life wouldn't be abundant on Earth, or you would have life that would be microbial only at a very low abundance level. As it is, we can have a wide diversity of life. Matter of fact, just before God created Adam and Eve, there were 8.7 million species of eukaryotic life forms on planet Earth. Our planet has the maximum carrying capacity, but one reason why it's able to sustain 8.7 million different species of eukaryotic life is because of abundant phosphorus. Now, when it comes to fluorine, and I think it was last week I mentioned that you need particular kinds of stars to make fluorine. Most of the fluorine we have comes from asymptotic giant branch stars, which means that our solar system must have formed adjacent to one or more of those stars in order to explain the superabundance of fluorine. We have 50 times as much fluorine as what we see elsewhere in our Milky Way galaxy and the universe. And, you know, we all take fluoride toothpaste, or you go to the dentist, he gives you a fluoride rinse, because we realize fluorine is important in order to have strong bones and strong enamel. However, you're probably aware that the dentist warns you about taking too much fluorine. Too much fluorine now becomes toxic in the human body. So again, it's a vital poison. Too little is toxic, too much is also toxic. So don't overdo that fluoride toothpaste. There will be consequences. But when it comes to sulfur, sulfur is an essential element. Sulfur is relatively abundant in human bodies, but we live on a planet that is 60 times less sulfur. Not only 60 times less than the rest of our Milky Way galaxy, astronomers are now able to measure the sulfur abundance on other solar system planets. Mars is where they got the most accurate measurement, and it turns out Mars has 60 times more sulfur than the Earth does. So the idea that you could grow vegetables on Mars, forget it. Way too much sulfur. Or the idea that we could live on its surface without some external help, like a special spacesuit. When you got 60 times more sulfur, or even 10 times more sulfur, you're gonna have a highly acidic environment. And so it's essential that a planet be relatively sulfur poor, extremely sulfur poor, as a matter of fact, so that life does not get poisoned here on Earth, so that we don't wind up with sulfuric acid, for example. Venus, just like Mars, has a huge amount of sulfur. And so sulfuric acid is one of the dominant components of Venus's atmosphere. And our atmosphere, we don't have to worry about quantities of sulfuric acid. And then when it comes to potassium, after phosphorus, potassium, after carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus, potassium is the most abundant molecule or atom element in our body. And notice our planet is 90 times richer in potassium than in what we see elsewhere in the Milky Way galaxy and our solar system. And so, and again, have you ever had one of these blood tests? They check you for potassium. Because potassium in the medical industry is recognized as being a very highly fine-tuned vital poison. And so if you got too little, you'll suffer from heart failure. You got too much, you'll also suffer from heart failure. So if you ever had one of these blood tests, they kind of give you this narrow range of potassium in your blood serum. It needs to be highly fine-tuned in order to keep you in optimal health. And if it gets even significantly out of whack, it can actually kill you. But our planet is just the right amount of potassium. And a lot of the potassium in your body is radioactive. And so you got potassium-39, potassium-40. Potassium-40 is radioactive. Fortunately, its half-life is just a little under 40 billion years. And so the fact that you got all this potassium in your body, yes, some of that will decay in your lifetime, but not enough to actually significantly shorten your life in any ways. However, in terms of a debate that's going on within the Christian community, Is the earth young or is the earth old? Was the flood of Noah global, wiping out the entire planet? Or was it simply the world in which ungodly people lived and their animals? Potassium plays a crucial role in that debate. I've been involved in a lot of debates on the extent of Noah's flood. And what you see with people who take a global flood model and a model in the context of young Earth, where during the flood we have virtually all the plate tectonic activity happening within a few months. In order to make that work, they have to accelerate the radiometric decay rates by a factor of at least a million, if not a billion times. However, when I've been involved in the debates, those who take the view different than I do say, we have a problem with the potassium, because if you accelerate the potassium decay rate by a factor of a million, there's way too much potassium in our body, and with a short decay constant, it basically kills you on the spot. Matter of fact, you get enough heat release that it would vaporize your bodies. And then moving on to carbon and nitrogen. Now, carbon is essential for life, probably the most important element for life, and yet when we look at our planet, we have 1,200 times less carbon than the average we see in the rest of our Milky Way galaxy and the universe. And with nitrogen, we're 2,400 times less. And carbon is the most essential element for life, but I put it in the category of a vital poison, because too little will kill you, too much will also kill you. And we're now finding planets outside of our solar system where we can measure the carbon abundance, the abundance of nitrogen, and the abundance of water. And what we're discovering is planet Earth is highly anomalous. We have only a tiny amount of carbon compared to Earth-like planets, where we can measure the chemistry, an extremely tiny amount of nitrogen. And when it comes to water, we come in at about 100 to 1,000 times less water than we're seeing on other planets that most closely match of the Earth. And water is essential for life, but that's the mantra of the astrobiology program at NASA. Follow the water. Water is essential for life. They're convinced if we find water, we're going to find life. What they're overlooking, however, is water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe. Number three after hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3. The universe is soaking wet. Yes, water is essential for life, but we need to be looking at the drier planets, Earth-like planets, because if you got way too much water, you know, we're all familiar, haven't you all been taught that water is a unique liquid and that in its frozen state, the ice is lighter than the liquid water and ice floats on top of the water. However, if you've got, say, 100 times as much water as we have here on planet Earth, that means you're gonna have oceans that are thousands of kilometers deep. And when you've got oceans that deep, liquid water oceans that deep, the pressure exerted by the liquid water on the water layers at the bottom is so extreme, you get a second form of ice. Ice that's actually denser than the water. And so it sinks. Well, now we don't see any of that ice here on planet Earth because there isn't the pressure to make that kind of ice. If you only got 4 to 6 kilometer deep oceans, the pressure is not high enough to make that kind of ice. But it is on these planets that have 100 times as much water as planet Earth does. And what happens there is that you get this ice that forms a barrier between the liquid water and the rock. And if you got a barrier, there's no possibility for any kind of life chemistry to occur. That didn't happen on the Earth because there is no barrier between the liquid water and the rock. They can make contact with one another. And the problem with having 1,200 times more carbon, carbon is a relatively light element. I mean, it's got an atomic weight of 12 in its most abundant form. And therefore, you're going to get a huge amount of carbon dioxide, methane, and carbon monoxide in the atmosphere. And those are all greenhouse gases. And so if you got 1,200 times as much carbon on the planet, you're going to have these thick atmospheres. And nitrogen is not a greenhouse gas. However, it is a catalyst in the sense that it will make the other greenhouse gases more efficient. And so nitrogen is a regulator of the greenhouse gases. But if you have 2,400 times as much nitrogen in the atmosphere, then that's going to greatly accelerate and magnify the greenhouse effect of methane, carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide, methane, and carbon monoxide. And so these are planets that are going to trap way too much heat from their host stars. And moreover, the atmosphere is going to be so thick that things like lungs simply are not going to be able to function. Gills and lungs, you're not going to be able to have big animals. They simply won't be able to function under those extreme atmospheric pressures. Now, these are just six of the 22 vital poisons. I discussed the others in this book, Design to the Core, and we mentioned one last week, molybdenum. Molybdenum comes predominantly from hypernova events. Hypernova are extremely rare stellar events in our galaxy, but they're essential in order to provide the molybdenum that we need. And I can give you the number. Our planet is five times as much molybdenum as what we see for the average of our Milky Way galaxy or the universe. But in this next slide, what I want to show you are the anomalous metals that are essential for human global civilization. And so if you've ever flown on an airplane, it's made up predominantly of aluminum and titanium. These are the light metals in the periodic table that don't corrode easily. So pure aluminum and pure titanium, they're much better than iron in terms of being stable and not corroding. They also have the advantage in that they're very light. And so we make airplanes of aluminum and titanium because they're strong metals that don't corrode, and they're lightweight. And notice we have 40 times as much aluminum, so we see elsewhere. And we now realize that the emerging solar system was bathed in aluminum 26, highly radioactive form of aluminum. None of it exists today, but we have a lot of aluminum 27, which is stable. And where does all this aluminum come from? Again, it comes from supernova eruption events. And so to explain this enormous quantity of aluminum, you would need the early solar system forming adjacent to the supernova eruption events that would bathe our planet in aluminum 26 and aluminum 27. Likewise with titanium, we got 65 times more titanium. And likewise, that requires us our solar system forming adjacent to several distinct different supernova eruption events. Now, I put yttrium in the table. That's 50 times more abundant. In fact, I'm curious, how many of you have ever heard of yttrium? Okay, a couple of you have heard of yttrium. You'll probably hear a lot more about it because, as you're aware, the whole world is trying to produce electricity from wind and solar and water power. And maybe they'll be moving into producing it from nuclear power. I hope they go down the thorium route. But one of the problems with generating all the electricity is getting it from the source, whether it be water power or the solar panels, and bringing it to people who are actually going to use it, which means you need these transmission lines. And hey, here in the LA Basin, all you need to do is look out the window, and you can see here these big transmission lines that are pulling power, say, from Hoover Dam, a couple hundred miles away. But one of the problems is you lose a lot of energy when you have those long pathway transmissions. And there's an article that got published just a few days ago saying, thanks to yttrium, we may be on our way to being able to have superconducting wires, certainly at liquid nitrogen temperatures. I mean, I grew up at a time when the only way you could see superconducting transmission was if you had liquid helium. And that means you got to get it down below 4 degrees above absolute zero. That's a hard and expensive technology to maintain. Moreover, helium is extremely difficult to contain. It escapes almost out of everything. But thanks to yttrium, we can now do it with liquid nitrogen. And it was published a few days ago. They now think there's even the possibility that we could get superconducting transmission at room temperature. And so yttrium is a key element in the periodic table that could really help us and be more efficient with our energy. If you're not familiar with superconducting wires, these are wires that have zero resistance. And so there's no energy loss when you transmit the electricity, even over, say, 2,000 miles. So it's a way to get a lot more electricity to the customer without a lot of energy loss. I think you're all aware that calcium is a vital poison. Calcium's essential in the skeletons of vertebrates, whether you be a mollusk like an oyster or a human being. You need calcium in your diet to have strong bones. So a lot of our body mass is made up of calcium. But you're also aware that you could be in danger if you take too much calcium. Too much calcium is going to be bad for your joints and your arthritis. Too little calcium, you're not going to have strong enough bones to support your body or to be able to move your body around, jump up and down, do high hurdles, that kind of thing. You need calcium. And notice, we have 20 times as much calcium as you'd expect on the surface of Mars or anywhere else in our Milky Way galaxy. That VP I put there is making the point, this is a vital poison. Copper, you need copper in your diet. And we have 20 times as much copper as you see elsewhere in our Milky Way galaxy. And copper is a vital poison. Consume too much, it will kill you. Consume not enough, it will also kill you. And typically people struggle getting enough copper in their diet. But I can tell you, living here in California, there's a lot of copper in our soil. So if you eat Californian growing vegetables, you'll get enough copper in your diet. Selenium's the other way around. Selenium is a vital poison. You need it in your body. It's crucial to make vitamin E, for example. But too much, just like too much vitamin E is a problem, too much selenium is a problem. Too little, too much. And yes, do we have a question here? Okay, I'll move on. Selenium. And so we live on a planet that's got 30 times less selenium. And so that's a problem people face is often they're taking supplements where they're building too much selenium in our bodies. It builds up and it can become toxic to your internal organs. But we have the optimal amount of selenium. Now, I just want to emphasize for you how extremely anomalous we're talking about. We're not talking a 10% difference or even a 50% difference. What you notice here is that we're talking a 4,000% difference. So 40, 50, 65, 20, 21, 30 times more or 30 times less. And so in every respect, these metals that are essential for our civilization and for our human health are at extremely anomalous levels, but these are all optimal. In each case, the abundance we see on planet Earth is optimal. We still have to watch the intake in our diet, but in terms of the plants we eat, the animal tissue we eat, it typically comes to us at the optimal level. And then we ended up last week talking about the R process elements, and we mentioned molybdenum. Not going to say too much about that, but we live on a planet that's got five times more molybdenum than we see elsewhere in our solar system, in our Milky Way galaxy. Same thing with iodine. Iodine was not recognized as a vital poison until about 80 years ago. And so they were recognizing that people were suffering from iodine deficiency. And so now you typically go to the grocery store and you can get this iodized salt, which ensures that you're getting the iodine at the optimal level. But notice, we live in a planet that's abundant in iodine by a factor of four. And you know, silver, that's something that's essential for a civilization. It's the best conductor of all the elements in the periodic table. copper is next. And we go back here in terms of our industrial application. We need lots of copper. We need lots of silver for our electronics industry. And we live in a planet that's got 20 times as much copper and 3 times as much silver. And so this enables us to have this efficient electronics that's essential for driving our civilization. The last three I put on here are the most anomalous of all: lead, uranium, and thorium. And lead only comes from a few sources. Lead comes from the decay of thorium, thorium-232, and uranium 235 and uranium 238. And so all the lead that's on our planet comes from the radiometric decay of those three isotopes. So the thorium-232, that decays into lead-208, and that's where all the lead-208 comes from, thorium decay. Uranium-238 decays into lead-207, and uranium-235 decays into lead-206. Or pardon me, 238-206, 235-207, thorium-232 into lead-208. Those are the three dominant isotopes of lead. That's where they come from. But in each case, you can see we live on a planet that's got a superabundance of these elements. 610 times as much thorium, 340 times as much uranium, and 170 times as much lead. Lead is an excellent element. You can mix it together with tin and you get bronze. It was one of the first elements in the periodic table to be harvested by early humans for metallurgy purposes, because it's quite easy to take out of different lead minerals. And so early humans basically found it was very easy to process lead from galena, for example. And actually, if you look at early Roman history, their vessels, their plates, their bowls, they were made out of lead until they discovered that, lead is toxic in high amounts. And I'm old enough to remember when they had leaded gasoline and they had leaded paint. We've now stopped the production of leaded paint and leaded gasoline, because even the tiny amounts that existed in the paint and the gasoline was enough to be toxic once you got people living past 70 years of age. So all of you here that are past the age of 70, aren't you glad we've stopped leaded gasoline and leaded paint? So. But one of the benefits of all this uranium and thorium is that these are long-lived radioisotopes. Thorium has a half-life of 14.1 billion years, uranium-238, 4.4, and uranium-235, 0.7 billion years. And so these take a long time to decay, and because our planet has so much of it, this keeps the interior of our planet warm. There's two sources of heat in the interior of the Earth. I've actually got three chapters on this book of the layers in Earth's interior, and I talk about just how crucial it is that we live on a planet that's super endowed with uranium and thorium, and because our planet formed as a result of the merger of two planets, the proto-Earth with Theia, that merging event generated an enormous amount of accretion heat that we still experience to this day, and the second biggest contribution to the interior heat of the Earth is the decay of uranium and thorium. And if it wasn't for that superabundance of uranium and thorium, we wouldn't have a molten core of iron and nickel and cobalt, and without that molten core, there'd be no magnetic field. Without the magnetic field, there'd be no magnetosphere. Without the magnetosphere, we all be killed within a few minutes from deadly cosmic and solar radiation. So thanks to all that uranium and thorium, we have a magnetosphere that protects us from the deadly solar and cosmic radiation. But what you'll also see in this book, we happen to fortuitously live in a galaxy that has a minimal amount of galactic radiation. We're looking at 40 times less than what you would get in the Andromeda galaxy. And likewise, we happen to be orbiting a star that's got a minimal amount of solar radiation. But we got this magnetosphere that protects us from those and allows us humans to be able to live past 100 years. And also all that uranium and thorium, the heat flow is a major factor in sustaining plate tectonics. And it's because, you know, our continents are being eroded down by wind and water, but the tectonics are creating new continents. And so we see a rough balance. So we live here in the state of California, and if you've ever been to the coast, you can see the effects of erosion. And so Malibu, for example, is becoming smaller and smaller as a result of the erosion of the ocean waves and the wind. But there's also lots of tectonic activity here in California that's pushing everything up. And actually, California, if you average it out over a long time, will become bigger. And so we're growing not just in our population, we're also growing in the fact that the landmass is getting bigger and bigger. Although we're not the fastest growing state in the union, the fastest growing state in the union is the state of Hawaii. On a percentage basis, it's growing faster because of its volcanoes. Again, a product of a plate tectonic activity that causes a lot of lava flow to flow in and makes the island, especially the island of Hawaii, bigger. So if you want to read more about this, it's in this book, The Creator and the Cosmos, in much more detail in Design to the Core. And yes, starting tomorrow, anyone can get a free copy. Well, not free. A donation of any amount to Reasons to Believe, and they'll ship you a copy of that book. You'll get it before the dot-coms begin to sell it. So take advantage of that. With that, I'm going to stop and take questions. And as usual, I'll take questions on any topic. It doesn't have to be focused on this. Next week, we'll be starting a new series, and I'm going to kind of focus on the highlights of what's in this book, Design to the Core, basically giving you the short course I gave at Biola University on this topic. And as usual, we'll alternate the questions from the in-person audience here and also with people that are participating virtually. For all of those of you watching through YouTube Live, this is a good time to put your questions. We put them in the chat feature. Is that where we want them?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, just post your questions in the chat feature and we'll get to you. So any questions, comments, statements? Yes, right here. And please, let's get the microphone so we can get this recorded.
I'd like any kind of comment you care to make about exoplanets and magnetospheres. Are we able to detect, and at what level regarding to radioactive essential we have here?
Yeah, good question. There's two relatively long chapters in this book on exoplanets. We've now found a little more than 5,000 planets beyond our solar system. And what I do in this book is compare the characteristics of those 5,000 plus planets with the planets in our solar system, basically dispelling a prediction that was made back in 1995 when they were discovering the first of these planets beyond the solar system, where astronomers were predicting that we're going to find planets just like the planets in our solar system. Turns out that's not correct. 5,000 exoplanets later, we find out that their characteristics are radically different from the planets in our solar system. The prediction was we'd be finding dozens, if not hundreds of planets just like planet Earth. Not only have we not found a twin of the Earth beyond our solar system, we've not found a twin of any one of the eight planets, which led to the discovery that every one of those eight planets has highly fine-tuned to make possible advanced life on planet Earth. With respect to your question, have they been able to detect magnetospheres around these planets? They're too far away with our current technology to be able to detect magnetospheres. Where we are right now, and the James Webb Space Telescope is going to, I mean, some time has been devoted on the James Webb Space Telescope to being able to measure the chemical abundances on several of these exoplanets. It's already been done for a few, but basically we're limited to measuring the water content, the carbon content, the nitrogen content. The goal is to be able to measure oxygen, ozone, and all these other elements. James Webb Telescope will have that power, but it will not have the power to determine if there's a magnetosphere. On the other hand, we can look at the host star, and that will help us to determine if there's any possibility that they could have a magnetosphere. And one of the things I mentioned in this book is that where you really need that magnetosphere to be powerful is in the early history of the planet. And I talk about the research that makes the point no planet by itself, no matter, even if it's got as much hydrogen or much uranium, and even if it's got this superabundance of uranium thorium, that's not enough to produce a magnetic field. To get the magnetosphere, you not only need a liquid iron core, you need to circulate that liquid iron to get a dynamo. And when that's not circulating, you won't get a magnetic field, so you need a mechanism to circulate it. And when the planet is young, it's going to have a liquid core without a solid core interior to that, and so you need another body close by to circulate that liquid iron. In the case of the Earth, we had the Moon. When the Moon first formed, it was about 4 Earth diameters away from the Earth. It was close enough that its tidal forces exerted on the Earth circulated the liquid iron, and it gave us a strong magnetosphere. And then the Moon, because it formed as a result of a merger and thea in the proto-Earth, it too had a liquid iron core, and the Earth's tidal friction exerted on the Moon generated a strong magnetic field where the two magnetospheres, because of how close the Earth and the Moon were to one another at that time, the magnetospheres basically blended, and you had a single magnetosphere around the Earth and the Moon. And it took the contribution of those two magnetospheres to give the early Earth a strong enough magnetosphere to ensure that the particle radiation from the Sun didn't sputter away all the water or all the atmosphere. We don't need that today because the particle radiation from the Sun has declined by at least a factor of 10,000 times. So we're not as great risk today. And the Earth's magnetosphere by itself is adequate to protect us from deadly solar and cosmic radiation. But this is where I think it becomes easy for the astronomers. If you want to have an adequate magnetosphere so that you can have any kind of life, not just animals and plants, but to even to have bacterial life, you need a coupled magnetosphere. You'll need a coupled magnetosphere in the early history of that planetary system. So you need a big Moon and a relatively big rocky planet close enough together with a hot enough origin that you get a coupled magnetosphere. That paper that did all that research was published in 2020, and they said it's a habitability requirement. I wrote all about it in this book. In fact, I'll be talking about it next week. I probably won't get to it next week, but it's part of the course, because in my opinion, it's the most restrictive habitability requirement that's ever been discovered. You're not going to have life on a planet unless you have a big rocky planet orbited by a big rocky Moon, where both of them have a liquid iron core that's being circulated by the mutual tidal friction. Those we now know are all requirements to have any kind of life. And I think it's easy to imagine that must be an extremely rare event anytime, anywhere in the universe. In fact, it's quite likely it's only happened once. We happen to be on the one planet where it happened. Okay, from the internet?
From the audience, excuse me, online, SlamRN asks, how do secularists account for the large amount and percentage of elements on Earth?
Well, as I've read the scientific literature, great question. One reason I put some of this in Improbable Planet, also put it in the fourth edition, The Creator and the Cosmos, and talk about a big time in this book, Design to the Core. My peers with PhDs in physics and astronomy who had been doing research on geophysics typically are not even aware of this. So as I mentioned, these statistics, these numbers, they're unique to Reasons to Believe. I've not found it anywhere else in the scientific literature. What you will find in the scientific literature are papers saying that Earth is super abundant in uranium and thorium, but they don't really go into how abundant we are. And they'll say things like we have a lot of molybdenum, but I don't know anywhere outside of Reasons to Believe where you see as a complete discussion as this. And so my prayer is that my peers, my secular peers, will actually begin to look at this evidence and begin to consider what it really means. But keep in mind, most scientists who are not theists, they talk about these things as being amazing facts, but they never consider the philosophical implications. And my whole point is, look how anomalous the abundance is of each of these elements. You might think that one of them is a sheer coincidence, but virtually every element in the periodic table is anomalous, not just by a little bit, but by a huge amount. By the way, one thing I'll also add to this, the superabundance of uranium and thorium on our planet means that it's possible for humans to have nuclear power reactors. We can use a superabundance of uranium and thorium to generate the energy we need to drive our civilization. And I've written articles on thorium saying that it's orders of magnitude safer than uranium nuclear power generation. And you get 300 times as much energy for the investment you put into it. My opinion, that's the way to go for energy generation. Thorium is super abundant, 3 times more abundant than uranium in the crust of the Earth, completely safe to mine, impossible to have a nuclear power station meltdown, and you can't make any weapons from it. And it could provide us with all the energy we need for at least a couple of millennia. Okay, do we have another question from the audience? Right over here.
Dr. Ross, on kind of the same vein, you mentioned sulfur abundance on the surface of Mars, and Matt Damon in The Martian, notwithstanding, NASA scholars, other space agency scholars, and scientists that work with Tesla, for example, what's their take on this idea of this drive to colonize Mars? We still have a drive around the world to do this, and the obstacles just seem so insurmountable, it's almost as if they're willfully ignoring this evidence.
Well, kind of like we got from Susan Lambeau over the internet, most of the people that are promoting this idea, let's colonize Mars, really are not taking into account that Mars has abundant elements relative to the Earth. And so only a few people are paying attention to this data. With 60 times more sulfur, you're not going to be able to grow anything using Martian soil. You want to grow something, you're going to have to bring Earth soil with you. Or you're going to have some kind of chemical plant on Mars that processes what's there in the Martian crust and gets it into the right ratios that you need. And people have been thinking, well, maybe we'll grow the food on Mars hydroponically. But to do that, you're going to have some kind of factory that reprocesses the Martian soil in order to get everything at the right level, which means we're talking another expense. And, as I've written too, one of the problems with Mars is you only got 40% of the gravity you have here on Earth. And it's now appreciated that, yes, gravity does mean that we have to work harder, but it turns out 1G is optimal for human activity and human health. And if you ever want to try it, there's about a half dozen NASA parks in our country where you can take your grandparents or your grandkids and go to a space camp. And at that space camp, they'll let you feel what it's like to walk around with lunar gravity, walk around with Martian gravity. They don't let you experience Jupiter gravity because that's 2.5 times what we have here, and they're concerned that people's health wouldn't be able to withstand it. But what you discover, even at 40% gravity, is that it's difficult to move your body. You were mentioning Matt Damon in The Martian. You know, one of the things that bothered me was, number one, he was growing food with Martian soil. So that can't happen. Way too much sulfur. And it's not just the fact that you got way too much sulfur. You don't have an adequate quantity of potassium or phosphorus. So you're not going to be able to grow stuff on Martian soil, nor are you going to be able to walk 20 kilometers on the surface of Mars. It showed Matt Damon walking like it was here on Earth. At 40% gravity, it's difficult. I mean, with 1G, you've got the optimal stability of your human body. That's not the case. And in particular, it's really difficult when you're at lunar gravity, which is one reason why they outfitted the astronauts that were on the moon with these 250-pound climate packs. It wasn't just to keep them at the right temperature, which is crucial, of course, but it's to make sure they had enough weight on their back that it somewhat compensated for the lack of gravity on the surface of the moon. Even so, those Apollo astronauts were in danger of injuring themselves if they didn't move their bodies just the right way. Well, here on Earth, you can walk like this. With lunar gravity, even with a 250-pound pack on your back, you have to move with a bunny hop. And so you kind of jump like this and like this. And you keep your legs far apart, because if you don't, you're going to fall. And you could injure yourself, you could damage your climate backpack. So notice in the later Apollo missions, they gave them a vehicle. So the idea was, we don't want you walking around on the moon. That's going to be dangerous. We're going to give you a vehicle that you can drive. So, and by the way, that's going to have to be done on Mars as well. You're going to need a vehicle. So, and incidentally, there's been a paper just published making the point that from an economic perspective, it's silly to send people to Mars. Number one, there's a high risk that they'll die even before they get there. Keeping them alive on Mars is an enormous problem. But the point they were making, we can learn everything we want about Mars for a whole lot less money by sending machines. And this article that just got published is saying the difference is a factor of 1,000 times minimum, 1,000 times cheaper to send machines, and basically saying the machines can give us information about Mars faster and in more detail than we can get by sending people. I mean, with the moon, it's nearby, and we don't have to worry. I mean, the nice thing about going to the moon is that the astronauts are protected by Earth's magnetosphere for about half the time. The other thing is you can time the mission to the moon to be the point where there's no major solar flares to worry about, or where you got the right solar wind to protect against cosmic radiation. You can pick your time window. And notice all the lunar missions were no longer than a week, and that was because they were concerned, hey, if we make it longer than a week, we're going to put these Apollo astronauts at risk. Keep the trip short, and they can be protected for a good chunk of the way. And I think an article got published just 2 days ago making the point where they've now studied people who've been up in the space station and recognized that they've greatly underestimated the amount of bone mass that's lost. Our human bodies are designed to be efficient. And so if the gravity isn't there, it stops making bones. Don't need the bones because there isn't the stress. And so, in fact, this is also true of all life. I remember my son he was growing peppers, and he was growing them in our living room. And they were just little spindly things going up there with very tiny trunks. And then he recognized, hey, if I transplant that outside, the pepper things will simply die. And so what he realized, he had to stress them. And so he bought a bunch of fans and was blowing fans on the peppers, and then they grow nice, strong, healthy stalks. But without the stress of the wind, they conserve energy. Same thing happens to us humans. So, but yeah, an article just got published is that we shouldn't be letting people stay on the space station for 3 months. The amount of bone mass they lose is significant. And by the way, we have a visiting scholar that's going to be joining us next month. And she was part of the Apollo, or part of the space station program. She's got a PhD in physiology, and she was being trained to go to outer space. What she shared with me, if you go to the space station, everybody on the space station has to spend 4 hours every day on a treadmill. And what they try to do, because they're worried about the bone loss, and so they actually strap bungee cords to you to try to simulate Earth gravity. And her comment is, it's not the same. It's really tough to try to run a treadmill with all these bungee cords attached to you. And then to do it for 4 hours straight, and it says, that's one reason why it's difficult to get people to volunteer to go up there. But if you don't spend those 4 hours a day, you'll come back, even in a few months, with so much bone mass, you'll die. That's what happened to Yuri Gagarin. He wasn't doing the required exercises, and when he came back from spending, I think, a couple of months in zero gravity, he was dead within a year. He simply didn't, and that's the problem. When you come back to Earth, your body is not able to rebuild that lost bone mass. Okay. Do you have another one from the audience?
Yeah, we do. Robert Gibson, he's asking about thorium nuclear reactors. I'll try to get this, but he says, do you prefer them to be based on molten salt as the solvent or solid fuel?
Well, the molten salt idea is being proposed for the nuclear reactors because, and I think it's... who is the guy that founded Microsoft? Bill Gates? He's pushing that we should build a whole lot of small uranium nuclear reactors that are using salt-based technology. The advantage is you can make the reactor smaller. And he claims that if you actually build thousands of these nuclear reactors, we can drive the cost down. What I've been proposing in my talks, forget uranium. Go with thorium. And not the salt technology, the breeder reactor technology. And you literally get 300 times as much energy per pound of thorium compared to uranium. And so you get a lot more energy, and it's safe. The people working in the nuclear power plant do not have to wear special clothing because the radioactive activity there is orders of magnitude less than what you get with uranium reactors. No possibility of a meltdown, and you can't use it to make nuclear weapons. The drawback is there is not one large-scale thorium nuclear reactor running in the world. Two small ones were built here in the United States in the early 1960s, so we know thorium nuclear power reactors work, but the remaining challenge is, can we scale them up to the appropriate size? I'm convinced we can. I don't see any engineering barrier to scaling up these small thorium reactors to big sizes where it could produce all the energy needs of our country. And U.S. is one of the more thorium-rich nations in the world.
There's a second part here. He says, would a CANDU, C-A-N-D-U, reactor work with thorium as nuclear fuel?
Again, the CANDU thing, that was something developed in Canada. It does deliver more energy per pound of uranium, but what I'm promoting is let's use thorium and let's use a breeder reactor. You're basically using the thorium to make uranium-232, which decays very quickly, and you get a huge amount of energy. So I've given a couple of talks on it that people can watch on YouTube about thorium nuclear power generation. And people ask me, well, how long would it take to scale it up to provide 100% of the energy needs of our country? I think it would take a decade. So that's one reason why I'm advocating we use natural gas as a way to buy us the time we need to generate energy through thorium nuclear power generation. If we were to stop all coal burning and go with natural gas burning, that would drop the greenhouse gas emissions by a factor of two. And you get no particulate emission. The real problem with burning coal is you get this black soot and these black particulates. And there's now evidence that, particularly for Siberia and Canada, that may be a more significant warming factor for those regions than the greenhouse gases, because all this black stuff falls on the ice and snow, and that means the ice and snow absorbs a lot more heat. So it explains why Canada and northern Siberia are warming up five times faster than the rest of the world. It's not just the greenhouse gases, it's all that soot from coal burning. So that, to me, is the fastest way to drop the greenhouse gas emissions. Stop coal, go with natural gas. It's cheaper than coal, easier to transport than coal, and you only get half the greenhouse gas emissions.
Do they have the ability to do that quickly?
Okay, the question was, do they have the ability to do that quickly? It's the fastest thing we could do to bring down the greenhouse gases, because you're basically, you don't have to change the power plants. You just stop using coal, use natural gas instead. So we're talking maybe a transfer time that would be in months as opposed to years. Yes, you'd have to retool the power plants, but it's a fairly inexpensive and quick step to do. And again, the natural gas is cheaper to mine, and North America especially is super endowed with natural gas. There's enough natural gas in North America to supply the whole world.
Yeah, thanks for the elements. The natural question comes is, since this is a times more comparison, what is it compared to? And I think you mentioned some stars, and I suppose spectroscopy. But are there a variety of baselines that you use in your field sample? And is that information given in your book, et cetera? And then sort of related to that, but different, but I think clear enough to identify, on the R process elements, the rapid neutron capture and the slow neutron capture, that's pretty much beyond iron for nuclear fusion.
Yeah, all the R process elements are heavier than iron.
Which is interesting to me in that iron is the most stable element for binding energy. That means the most stable nucleus possible.
Yes.
Anything below iron is fusion-based. Anything above is fission-based.
It's fission-based, correct.
They're both less stable than iron and some related elements around iron. Have you ever thought, for fine-tuning argument, to look, and maybe you do, at how helium is more stable than number 3, 4, and 5 on the periodic table, boron, beryllium, and so forth, up to carbon, but then carbon is the most stable after helium, thus we get a lot of carbon, and then on up to iron, but that's an interesting design feature to me.
Yeah, we covered that in the first lecture of this series, so I know you weren't here for that, and there is a section in this book designed to the core on that. Basically, and this was all worked out at Caltech in 1956, there were four astronomers and physicists, Willie Fowler, Margaret and Jeffrey Burbage, and it was Fred Hoyle, who literally got together, and it's the most cited physics paper ever, because they figured out how we get all the elements we see in the periodic table, but they especially focused on the problem of getting from helium to getting to carbon and oxygen. And beryllium is a key factor. So in that lecture, and again, you can download it off of paradoxes.org and off of YouTube, it basically talks about what those four scientists discovered. And you need highly fine-tuned ground state energy levels of helium, beryllium, carbon, and oxygen in order to get a universe that has abundance of both carbon and oxygen, where oxygen is slightly more abundant than the carbon. And those are all crucial in order to have a wide diversity of life. And so after hydrogen and helium, oxygen is the most abundant element in the universe, and carbon is fourth. But getting that abundant is a problem. On the other hand, as I mentioned back here, yes, there's lots of carbon and oxygen in the universe. There must be lots of carbon and oxygen to make life possible. But also, we happen to live in a planet that's extremely poor in carbon and nitrogen, not poor in oxygen. Oxygen is actually the most abundant element in the Earth. And then we're also underabundant in water. But those are all crucial features to get advanced life. So incidentally, that paper was published in 1956. It's now available to the public for free. So, but. Okay, how I develop these statistics is recognizing that Earth is not anomalous when it comes to iron and manganese. Manganese is the element just below iron in the periodic table. And that's helpful because, as you mentioned, iron is the most stable element in the periodic table. The heavy elements will fissile, and they'll fissile all the way down to iron. And then you've got the fusion of hydrogen helium, and you get fusion all the way up to iron. Iron is where everything stops. But for that reason, iron is quite abundant in the universe. And so what I've done here is to compare the abundance of elements in the Milky Way galaxy and our universe with respect to iron and manganese. And so, because that's something that's normative for the Milky Way galaxy, the universe, and the Earth's crust, they're all about the same. And so, okay, comparing, say, the abundance of phosphorus on planet Earth to the abundance of iron, comparing the abundance of potassium to the abundance of iron, the abundance of lead all the way down the line. So that's how the calculations were done. I mean, as I mentioned, we're basically subtracting out the hydrogen and the helium, but taking advantage of the fact that iron is so abundant in all three places, that's where you get the best and most accurate numbers to compare. But all that's explained in here. You get a briefer explanation also in Improbable Planet, which came out in 2016.
You want one more question?
Yeah, one more question, okay. And then we'll wrap it up.
Has even a single exoplanet been found that might even be slightly likely to be habitable?
Well, if you go on the NASA website, they'll tell you that there are probably 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy alone. But if you read what they put up there on the internet, they're only taking into account what they call the liquid water planetary habitable zone. And they're also looking at that in a very optimistic way. And so they're basically calculating what's the probability that a planet will have liquid water for a month or two on a small part of the surface of its planet. Well, that's not really a habitability requirement, because if you want to have life, you're going to need water hanging around a lot longer than a few months, and you want it to be more than just a few square kilometers. You need lots of water, but having too much water is just as big of a problem in that you get this second kind of ice. And so even if liquid water is the only habitability requirement you're looking at, you get numbers that are much more remote than 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy. And what I notice on the NASA website, they're not taking into account that planets orbiting stars less massive than our star, the Sun, are going to be tidally locked. And tidally locked planets, as I explain in this book, are not candidates. Because most of the stars in the universe are stars that are less massive than the sun. And so that's where NASA gets a very optimistic number. They assume that the best place to look for life is planets orbiting M-type stars. These are planets that are less than half the mass of our star, the sun. But at that low of a mass, in order to be in liquid water habitable zone, the stars that are less than half the mass of our star, the sun, their luminosity will be 1/16th or less than the luminosity of the sun, which means for their planets to be in liquid water habitable zone, they have to be orbiting the star very closely. And if they orbit the star very closely, they'll be tidally locked. Say, what's that? Our moon is tidally locked to the Earth, which means it's so close to the Earth that the tidal forces exerted by our planet have forced one side of the moon to always face the Earth. And in the case of a planet orbiting a star, that means one side faces the star all the time, the other side does not. So the front side is going to be scorching hot, the back side is going to be just a little bit more than absolute zero. And those stars will be bone dry. They could have liquid water on them. The problem is, as I explain in this book, if the planet is tidally locked, and even if it's only partially tidally locked, like say Venus is, or Mercury is, any water on the sun side or the shadow side is going to wander to the backside where it becomes permanently frozen. Those planets will have no liquid water. They will be bone dry, actually, for several reasons. Now, the real problem is NASA has not taken into account that in the published scientific literature, we now know of 14 different planetary habitable zones. The liquid water gives you the highest number of planets. The other 13 give you much lower numbers. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 14 zones. And so far, we found only one planet that simultaneously resides in even 3 of those habitable zones. It's the same one that resides in all 14, and you get one guess which planet that is. Okay, we'll stop here. Next week, we'll start the new series, so we'll see all of you next week.
Can you dismiss us with a prayer?
I'll finish with a prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the special privilege of you choosing us to be alive in the 21st century, a century when knowledge is exploding, just like it says in Daniel 12:4. We're living in those days when knowledge is just exponentially increasing. And Father, that gives us an opportunity to see on a daily basis how what you're revealing through the book of nature, as scientists are discovering and studying the book of nature, every day, that's giving us more evidence for the supernatural handiwork of God. I pray that we would examine that evidence. Lord, that evidence would cause us to receive more of your love, life, and truth, and we would share that with people that we know. In Jesus' name, amen.